Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
What's up, Paul? Today's show is truly special. My guest, infectious disease physician Dr. Harley Rotbart, speaks in depth on his new book, No Regrets Living, Seven Keys to Wonder and Contentment. In a book originally intended to offer wisdom and insight for his children, Harley Rotbart takes us through an essential process for living a life that really matters. He gets personal, candid, and maybe even a bit controversial. Well, truthfully, I think perhaps it's me that gets controversial, but what's new? Let's delve into my conversation with Dr. Harley Rotbart and No Regrets Living. Harley Rotbart, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Charlie, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this show. I love the title of your book, as I will talk about later, and our brief conversation we had beforehand. I think we have lots of things to discuss. But, you know, one of the things I noticed, first of all, as I looked you up on Amazon, it seems that in addition to be a successful physician, you are also the author of at least 6 books. Is that correct?
I have to recount, but I think that's the right ballpark.
So writing is obviously a passion as well as medicine.
You know, Charlie, I always wanted to be a writer from high school on. I wrote the high school yearbook. I wrote the high school newspaper. I got to college and I wrote for the college newspaper. And I just finally convinced myself that I had to find a way to make a living, because writing was probably not going to be it. And I spent the next almost 40 years writing medical and scientific papers for the technical literature and for my colleagues in medicine and in research. And all along, I felt as if I was stifling the creativity I felt that I could have developed had I continued the passion for writing. And so I finally, as I got to a point in my career where I could spend some evenings not on call, pardon me, and try to stretch the writing from the typical results and discussion that you have to write about in the scientific literature, extend that to a more creative place.
Right.
I finally sat down and wrote a baseball book.
You did. On Deck Circle, is that what it's called?
The On Deck Circle of Life. Yeah.
The On Deck Circle of Life. Yeah, that is that's the hitter's hell.
Exactly. But it's also the best place to observe and to learn and to prepare. Standing in the on deck circle is sort of the metaphor for being an observant person in life and taking advantage of the lessons that are presented in front of you, and making the most of your opportunity when you finally get to the plate. And so it's that type of metaphorical exercise that first little book was about. And I'll tell you, of all the, and I'll take your word for it, of all the 6 that I've done, and the 5 that have come after that, that remains my all-time favorite. My publisher listening to this is going to shoot me for not saying the current book is my favorite, but I am so fond of the little baseball book that it remains my favorite.
Well, I'll satisfy your publisher by talking about your new book. How's that?
Thank you. So
your publisher will say, okay, we have a little redemption there. You know, just briefly, you know, when you talk about a physician writing, are you familiar with Alan Lightman?
Oh, sure.
Alan Lightman is a physicist at MIT who is, he is, you know, has the odd position of being in the Department of Physics, and he's also in the English department teaching writing, and he's a brilliant writer. I love Alan's writing.
There are colleagues in medicine, and I hope to someday be thought of in the same context, but I clearly don't feel I am yet. But there are colleagues in medicine who have accomplished the same thing, who have really written profound work. I'm doing my best, but there are colleagues who I greatly admire who have succeeded in that kind of a diverse spectrum of accomplishment. And Lightman in his two careers clearly is one of those people, not in medicine, but as you pointed out, as an MIT physicist.
But you know, Oliver Sacks sort of fits into that room in that realm.
Absolutely.
Does he not? Yeah.
Absolutely. And we are actually friends with his first cousin, with Oliver Sacks' first cousin, who lives three blocks from me here in Denver. Oliver Sacks sadly passed away, of course, recently.
And, yes.
And yet his work is his work really tickles the fancy of people with no medical background because of how insightful he is about mental illness and about psychological problems. And I'm in admiration of his work as well.
Well, I am of yours, and I think as physicians, you know, you bring such an entirely different perspective. You know, you see life through another window that the rest of us can't see life through that window. We don't have the technology or the information to do that, nor the wherewithal. And so you bring so much. And your title of this new book, I mean, it really intrigued me. I love the idea of no regrets living. I think we spend too much time regretting and not enough time savoring. And so what I'd like to begin with in this is, let's do a little bit of definition of terms, Harley.
Sure.
When you speak of regrets, what kinds of things come to your mind?
Well, I had an experience in medical school that defined that for me. I cared for, and I write about this in the book, I cared for a man in his early 50s who was diagnosed with a terminal disease. And as a medical student, we don't have much responsibility for medicine. We have responsibility to learn. And so I spent a lot of time at bedside talking to this man. So I was in my mid-20s, and he was dying in his early 50s. And we talked about his regrets. We talked about all that he had put off, that he had not been able to accomplish in his life, that he had not been able to see, to do, to enjoy. And we also talked about the parts of his life that he had done that he was sorry about, felt badly about, wish he could do over again, but now it's too late. So we looked at his past regrets, and we looked at his regrets about the future that he was never going to have. And that stuck with me for a long time. So I'm now 40 years past that conversation. But I'll never forget it because, first of all, it was inspirational. It forced me to live my life not wanting to end up with that feeling at the end of my life. And who knows when the end of our lives will occur. So it could be tomorrow. And so we have to live our lives, and that's the concept of no regrets living, to live our lives anticipating, not fearing, but anticipating how we'll feel at the end. One of the closing chapter in the book, I talk about my favorite country western song, and that's Tim McGraw's Live Like You're Dying.
Right.
And it's a beautiful song, and it almost tells the story exactly of the 50-year-old man that I took care of 40 years ago, and the feeling that that he had for not being able to do all that he had wanted to do, for feeling badly about some of the things that he had done that he could no longer correct. And so it really, whether you're dying or not, it really is sort of incumbent on all of us to act as if we were, to love more deeply, to care more, to experience more, to share more. And those are the the kind of lessons of that 50-year-old man and of Tim McGraw's song and a hope of the book.
I have a comment and then a question. I had I did a podcast last week that we'll publish next week, titled "I've Seen Dead People," and it was with a deputy coroner, and right. We came to the conclusion that, you know, it's very popular to say, act as if today is the first day of the rest of your life, and
right.
And I suggested, what if we acted as if today was the last day of the rest of our life?
Exactly, Charlie. Exactly. And that, I think that is profound. And I agree with you completely. I think that if we see every day as the day to make the most of what's left, to make the most of that day, because who knows where we're going to wake up or if we're going to wake up the next day. I think that's a very profound question you asked, and I agree with you.
Thank you. I do have a question before we get more deeply into the book, which this will get into the book, but I have a question because so many of us, you know, after decades of living, have regrets, although I really don't have a lot of regrets. I feel like I dealt with life with the cards that were given me, and I made decisions based on that. Would I make different decisions today? Probably. Nevertheless, those decisions made me who I am today. But there are a lot of people that don't feel that way. There are a lot of people that live in sort of remorse over regretful activities. How do you address those people? What kind of encouragement do you give to them?
Well, we are imbued with the power to forgive ourselves. And I'll give you an example. And I'm still working on it for myself. I share your blessing of not having many regrets in my life and feeling as if I acted and reacted to what I was faced with as I was faced with it. But I do have a regret that I write about in the self-forgiveness portion of the book. And that is that my career as a physician was, I'm an infectious diseases physician, pediatrician, pediatric infectious diseases. So I took care of, for more than three decades, the sickest patients at Children's Hospital of Colorado. I took care of, I made the diagnosis of the first child with AIDS in Colorado. I took care of the kids who had bone marrow and organ system transplants and became infected with severe and oftentimes fatal infections, opportunistic infections. I spent 30 plus years in the hospital in doing what I felt was a noble battle for the sickest kids. But other colleagues of mine who were fighting the same battle, not necessarily in infectious diseases, but in other specialties of medicine, found the time to go to developing countries in crisis, Haiti following the earthquake, and Africa to build villages, to India to work in the most underprivileged areas of the Asian continent. I had colleagues who did that, somehow managed to do that, despite the noble fight that we were all fighting at home, and I never had the courage to do it. I never had the courage to leave the comfort of my home, and granted, the difficulty of my career, but I never had the courage to leave. And I told myself that the reason I didn't do it was contextual. That is, I had young kids, and how could I leave my wife with young kids for a month at a time, or 2 weeks at a time, for that matter, to go abroad to deliver general pediatric care where it was mostly needed. But I also told myself that I had lost some of my general pediatric skills, that after all those years in the ICU and in the trenches of really, really sick kids, I wasn't sure I could remember how to make the diagnosis of rashes and ear infections and pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And pneumonia was not an infectious disease diagnosis. It's a general pediatric diagnosis for the most part. I wasn't confident that I had those skills, and I was wrong, because it would have come back. And I regret the lack of courage. I regret the lack of conviction to do what colleagues of mine did. So I've now begun to forgive myself. I've told myself what I've just told you, that there was context that prevented me from doing it, that there was fear that prevented me from doing it, and I have begun to forgive myself. And I think that that's the lesson of regret. When we look back, and it's actually what I hope I told, I wish I could remember, what I hope I told that 50-year-old man when I was in medical school, and that is, it's time to forgive yourself. It's time to recognize that decisions that are made in context. And you can't take the context away from the decision. Looking back, we remember the decision, but we have to also remember who we were at the time, where we were at the time, who was dependent upon us at the time, and that will help us to forgive ourselves.
You know, I strongly believe in forgiveness, and especially forgiveness of self. And there's a part of me, if I were your spiritual director, I would suggest that what you're doing now, what you do with children, what you do with infectious diseases, what you're doing with your books, you are doing a calling, and as we both, you know, have faith traditions, that you are doing a calling of God, and that your calling of God was not overseas. And so I would even challenge that to say, you know, okay, forgive myself for my selfishness, because we're always selfish, but that I think it sounds to me like you are obeying a calling, sacrificing in that calling, but that's a whole different discussion. But that would be, if I were your spiritual director, that would be my encouragement for you.
You know what? That's so beautiful. Yeah, I mean, you've just become my spiritual director. That's such a beautiful way of saying it. And I really don't think I've ever thought of myself as having a calling. I've had a career. I've had a fulfilling career. I feel like I've fought the good battle. But I don't know that until you just said that, I don't know that I would ever have included a calling in the context that I was speaking about as part of self-forgiveness. So thank you for that and for becoming my spiritual director.
Well, it's my honor. You know what I do want to do, and I want to get into your book, but you know, you told me, and if we could just kind of highlight this, what led you to write this book in particular? And there were some things that you told me over the phone a few days ago that I thought would be really interesting to our listeners. Could you sort of briefly Sure. give me an idea of what led you to write No Regrets?
Sure. Thanks for asking. I wrote that book, No Regrets Living, as a legacy book for my kids and only for my kids. They would be the audience. By the time I sat down to write this book a year and a half or so ago, I had reflected on the fact that my father, may he rest in peace, died before he knew my wife and died before he knew my kids. He was a survivor of the Auschwitz concentration camp in Germany and came to America to make a life here and had two sons with my mom and died at age 58 from pancreatic cancer after a 13-month illness. I had not yet met Sarah. We obviously didn't have our kids, so he never knew his grandchildren and never knew my wife. And at the time that he was in his 50s and up to the time that he was dying at the end of his 50s, I was in the go-go years of my life. I was sure. training, I was learning, I was taking night call, pardon me, and I just didn't have the time. I wish I would have figured out how to make the time, but I didn't have the time to hear about his life as much as I would have liked to hear what he thought about life, to hear what his values were. I can assume them from seeing how he lived his life. And I know a lot about my dad. I mean, we spent a lot of time together, especially when I was younger. But the deep-rooted questions, after Auschwitz, did you believe in God, Dad?
The soul questions.
After Auschwitz. I'm sorry?
The soul questions.
The soul questions. I did not ask those questions. And my kids are in the go-go years of their lives now. And I am blessed to be able to see them frequently. But we don't have the time to discuss the soul questions. We're talking about the grandkids in preschool. We're talking about the dilemmas that they have at work. We're talking about their go-go years. We're not talking about what I want them to know about me. And I hope that they, from knowing me, already recognize a lot of that, as I do about my dad. But I wanted to put it down on paper.
Yes.
And I wanted them to have it for when they slow down long enough, they could read it. And then they kind of looked at it, and I shared it with a few close friends, and they convinced me collectively that maybe this has a message for more than just my kids, and thankfully the publisher agreed, and that's how the book came about.
Brilliant. That's brilliant. That's my times with Maury, didn't that, whatever, you know, that's not the title, but Tuesdays with Maury,
yeah,
wasn't
Tuesdays
that the way
Maury.
That yeah. started, that was not intended to be a book?
Absolutely.
Was...
Absolutely. And I think that what that book did for readers was help people recognize that in some ways we become more profound as we reach the end of our lives. And I love my life, and I hope it goes on for a long time. But I do think I feel more profound, and I don't mean to sound self-aggrandizing, but I feel more profound now than I was 20 years ago or 40 years ago.
That's because you
and
are.
I feel like, I don't know. Maybe my spiritual director that you are. You're just telling me that. But I do feel as if I have more to say. 6 years ago, I had quadruple bypass surgery. Before that, I was really not much of a patient. I mean, I had a few things, but being on the other side of the bed gave me a profundity that I couldn't have had before I was on that side of the bed. And so life's experiences all contribute to our maturity, of course, but to also our wisdom. And I would urge everyone to take a look at their lives, the perspectives that they've had, and to consider putting some of it down on paper.
Oh, yes. And in conversation, my son and I, you know, that is one thing I feel blessed with, is that we talk about ideas of the soul, philosophy of life, goals of life. You know, we go deeper into, did you get a hit today? And did you catch a two hitter? Those are sort of secondary subjects to what is going on in life. But that is, you know, that's also due to my, you know, my proclivity for always philosophizing. So I'm sure it gets tiring to many people. Now, before we head on to our break, I do want to get into your book. I'd like to talk about your book. And I must admit, now, as much as I loved No Regrets Living, I think the subtitle is equally as outstanding. And the subtitle is Seven Keys to a Life of Wonder and Commitment. And I'm sorry, Wonder and Contentment. I was thinking it's very similar to the words in my website that, you know, we're in search of meaning, adventure, and awe. That there seems to be some interplay there. Tell me more about wonder and contentment. What does that mean in your world, Harley?
Well, it's it means, first of all, opening our eyes to miracles. I am a collector of miracles.
You wrote a book on it.
I did. It's called Miracles We Have Seen, and it's a collection of 75 essays by some of the most esteemed physicians in the world about cases, essays written about cases that they had seen, that they've witnessed, that either they couldn't explain, and so were miraculous in the sense of mystery, or were miraculous in the sense of being unforgettable and moving in a way that wasn't always a happy ending, but moving in a very significant way. And so I collect those miracles, and those are in the book that you mentioned. But I also collect other miracles. I collect the miracle of hummingbirds, for example. Hummingbirds flap their wings 80 times per second, 80 times per second to stay aloft. Bats are blind. Yeah. We talk about blind as a bat. Bats are blind. And yet they're able to consume 1,000 mosquitoes a night because the sonar that they emit reflects off of the mosquitoes and allows them to detect the mosquitoes and to feed their young. And I think viruses are miraculous. And in this era of pandemic, nothing could sound more heretical than that, that viruses are miraculous. But I can't make a virus. No one has yet made a virus. Viruses, on the other hand, can infect a single cell, and within a matter of a few hours, they can make 1 million copies of themselves. And those copies of viruses, those other viruses, spread to nearby cells, and that's why we feel so sick when we have the flu or when we have COVID-19 or when we have any other virus infection. Viruses are miraculous. Miraculous because none of us understand them fully. Someday we may understand them better, but we haven't made one. And even if someday we're able to make one, Charlie, we'll have to ask where the miracle came from that gave us the ingenuity and the creativity to be able to do that. And where did the raw materials come from? There's miracles everywhere, not just in medicine, not just in the hospital. There's miracles everywhere. And that's how you get to wonder. And contentment is acknowledging that we will never understand all of that. We have to accept certain things as fate, certain things as given. And when we do that in the context of belief in something that's greater than ourselves, we achieve contentment. So wonder is an appreciation of the miracles around us, and contentment is an acknowledgement, a humility about our place as not being the be-all and the end-all in the universe.
Two questions again. One is the smaller one, and the second is the larger one. Would you equate, because as I hear you define contentment, and I was thinking contentment, is that not what is talked about in spiritual leaders as peace? Is that not
absolutely?
Is that not peace to just accept as it is and to be content with the world as it is?
That's exactly right. Not content to the extent that we don't try and make things better.
Right.
We can't accept things as they are without seeking to heal, seeking to improve, seeking to move the trajectory of humankind further in the right direction. Yes, I think the contentment that we feel is an acknowledgement, as I said, that we're never going to understand at all. We're never going to understand at all. And there are things that are going to happen that are out of our control. And with that, we can find peace. With that, we can find contentment. But I think we need to always be seeking, and that's another one of the chapters in the book. I think we always need to be seeking better.
Well, you just spoke about the three things that I want to talk about in the seven keys to a life of wonder and contentment in No Regrets Living. And before we get into that, I think we need to take a break, because we will go down deep and stay down long in those subjects. So just bear with me a couple of minutes. Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And today, I have a very special guest, Dr. Harley Rokebart, and he is the author of No Regrets Living, Seven Keys to a Life of Wonder and Contentment. And it is utterly a brilliant book, and Dr. Rokebart is a well-known physician in infectious diseases, has written six books, and I can't wait to discover more now about the subtitle of the book, about the seven keys to a life of wonder and contentment. And so, Harley, what I'm thinking, can you give us just a brief overview of your seven keys? And then I have, since I get to be the host of the show, I've selected three and you've already mentioned the three, so it seems like we're in sync on the three. But can you give us a brief overview, a synopsis of what the seven keys to a life of wonder and contentment are?
Sure. Thank you. The first and the most important key is belief. And I know what I believe, and I've written in the book about what I believe. I would never tell anyone else what they should believe. But I think that the most important key to a life of wonder and contentment is the belief in something greater than ourselves, the belief that there is a level of understanding, a level of knowledge in the world that we will never attain. There are 70 billion trillion stars. That's 10 to the 22, 70 billion trillion stars in the world. And if I think that I am the most highly evolved species in the universe, or the most important species in the universe, all I have to do is go out at night and look at those 70 billion trillion stars, and I can only see a tiny, tiny fraction of them. And so I have to believe that there's something greater than us. For me personally, that's a belief in God. Other people can choose what they believe in, but it cannot be solely a belief in ourselves. That then leads us to the second key, which is discovery. And Albert Einstein said this beautifully. He said, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as if nothing is a miracle, and the other is as if everything is a miracle. Mm-hmm. And I'm in that latter category. I believe that once we have that firm belief, we then discover all the miracles around us. And I mentioned hummingbirds, and I mentioned bats. I mentioned viruses. How about the miracle of a sperm meeting an egg and creating a human being? Yeah. How about that miracle? So the discovery leads us to a concept of the Messiah in the same key. And I have a different concept of Messiah than a lot of people. But it actually syncs up with what a lot of people believe. I think that each of us have a kernel of the Messiah within us, that each of us, created in the image of God, has also a kernel of the Messiah within us. And that when the Messiah comes or comes back, that will be when those kernels of our Messiah emerge and merge to form a greater goodness in the world. And that's a discovery of our internal goodness that follows the first key of belief. The third key.
And just, you know, let me support that by saying the historical Christian mystics would agree with you in totality. They would not disagree with you that there is a kernel of the divine, that there is a divine Messiah, the divine Christ, was in us at creation. It was not a second. It was not a plan B. It was a plan A that's already there. So please go on with healing.
I believe that concept of the internal spark. Then the third key is to heal. And that's the recognition, and you mentioned before, contentment. This is healing the world is the antithesis of being content with everything that's around us. I do believe we can get to a stage of contentment, as we discussed before, but I think we also have to recognize the power that we've been given to heal. We have healed diseases. We have cured pandemics. In medicine, there are many, many examples of healing, but there's also examples in the rest of the world. We have used our prepared minds, our creativity, to be able to protect the world from devastating earthquakes by building stronger buildings. Unfortunately, not in every part of the world, but in the parts of the world that we've been able to do that, a terrible 7.7 Richter scale earthquake occurred in Alaska in the last few years, and there were no injuries, and there were no buildings that fell. Why? Because we have healed the world, the part of the world that can afford those resources. We have healed the world of earthquakes in some ways. I think now we need to heal the world of evil, and I believe we can. There's evidence that we have healed many, many other things. I think we now need to heal the evil of the Holocaust, the evil of racism, the evil of guns. We just had the tragedy of the shootings in Boulder. Before that, a week before, the tragedy of the shootings in Atlanta. We need to heal. We need to heal the world. And that is, as we make steps toward that, we can achieve that sense of wonder and contentment. The fourth key is appreciation. And that I believe very strongly in, that we need to spend some time every single day giving thanks for what we have. And what I've discovered in doing that is that every single day there's more. It's not just, of course, I reiterate that I'm thankful for my family and for my kids and for my health and for my wife's health. Of course, I'm thankful for the things that I was thankful for yesterday. But every single day, I find new things to be thankful for, and it doesn't take a very long time to spend appreciating all the things that we have to be thankful for, and in that is appreciation for our families. And those of us who are blessed to have family, I think we need to spend more time recognizing, as you just said about your son, we need to spend more time recognizing the blessings of family. And then the fifth key is to accept. And that's an acceptance of, that we've talked about before, an acceptance of fate, an acceptance of reward and punishment, an acceptance of the concept that time, linear time, may not be the best explanation for everything that happens in our lives. There may be another time element besides linear time. And I think accepting those unknowns, fate, reward and punishment, non-linear time, are all things that I wrote about in that fifth key. The sixth key is to seek self-forgiveness, as we've talked about, but also to seek purpose. I adhere not to everything that the psychologist Viktor Frankl wrote in his Man's Search for Meaning, but I adhere to his general premise that those people who have found purpose in their lives extend their lives and improve their lives, and improve the lives of people around them. And then finally, the seventh key is to grow. Growth for me begins with a recognition of what I call the mile markers in our lives, the inflection points that have changed us in not necessarily subtle ways, but oftentimes in dramatic ways. And to look back and recognize that where we are today is the product of the mile markers, the growth that we've had up until now, and that gives us a perspective of how we want to grow beyond that and how we want to live as if we were dying. And that sort of concludes the seven key summary.
You know, those are really good. I am not a big fan of lists, and you know that they typically fail, but this list is very interesting to me, and there's not a single element that I don't agree with that I think are important. Do you have now I'm going to get scientific on us. Do you have a way of metricizing this, of of people seeing where they are on the belief scale, discovery, heal, appreciation, etc.? Do you have any kind of process like that that you use?
Well, I have one for myself, and I try to express that. I try to express that in the book, and I hope that it doesn't come across as a list in the book, but rather as a progression. And each of those keys, belief leads to discovery. Discovery leads to our desire to heal. When we begin to heal, we can appreciate the work that we've done and the work that others have done. We can accept, as a result of that appreciation, we can accept who we are and what we can and what we cannot do. And that leads us to seeking purpose and to growth. And for me, the metric of that is how far along that progression we are able to reach and how quickly we're able to reach it. And I think all of us can get through those seven keys, through that progression, every single day of our lives.
Right. It is a daily process. Agreed.
A daily process. But recognize that tomorrow we'll do it better. Tomorrow, yeah, we will benefit by the experience of our progression today and make even a greater progression.
This is the third week I've said this, and people are going to get tired of hearing this, but it's a phrase that sort of drives my life, is that we are who we are. We are who we have been becoming. And that's,
yep,
and that's what you're talking about in the progression. You know, I have a little,
I have
a little metric that I use in my different values that I try to incorporate in life, and my metric is simply plus check or minus, and I give myself check plus or check minus, and I go through it. I don't go through it daily because I don't have time, but I go through it monthly, and I see, do I give myself, did I excel? Was I average? Did I need to work on it? Need improvement? And anything that got a check minus or below, I then evaluate, do I need to work on that? I'm selecting three of these. And if you want to talk about another, you know, as we talked about before, you're the soloist, you're John Coltrane, so you get to play whatever instrument or whatever solo you care to play. But I want to talk about belief. Let's because I think you rightly put it at the beginning, and belief in a power outside yourself, whether you call that power God, call it source, call it whatever you want to call it. But there is something, you know, I'm a member of AA, and AA, you know, really typically is very strong on a power apart from ourself. What does that mean to you?
Well, on May 20th of 1964, two scientists were listening through a very powerful audio telescope, and they heard an echo that they had never heard and no one else had ever heard before. And they knew then when to dial in frequency to dial in on the audio telescope, and they were able to hear it all the time. And now you can hear it on the internet because it's now on a website, because that's the sound of the Big Bang.
Really?
The Big Bang was discovered on May 20th, 1964, by hearing an echo, which you can now hear. Anyone who tunes into that website can hear it. I wish I could tell you the website, but I don't have it in front of me. But it's easily found. I believe in the Big Bang. I believe in science. I've written dozens of papers in the scientific literature, and I believe what I wrote. Until and unless it's proven otherwise. Ditto for the Big Bang. Hippocrates wrote the theory of the four humors and the four temperaments. That was a now laughable scientific theory, but it persisted for centuries. So I always have to put an asterisk on telling you the science that I believe in, because it's unless and until proven otherwise, as Hippocrates' science was proven otherwise. So I believe in science. I'm a scientist. But I also believe that science will never answer the fundamental questions. For example, what happened before the Big Bang? What was there that, and forget what happened before. That for me is the most perplexing and completely unanswerable question. But the Big Bang says that there was a singularity, a tiny, infinitesimally small spot into which every single atom and molecule that became the universe was somehow compactly fit in. And then it exploded. Big Bang is the most understated explanation for anything I've ever heard, because this was a really Big Bang. Every single thing that we see around us, every one of the 70 billion trillion stars, every hummingbird, every sperm and egg, every virus, every molecule and atom was somehow packed into this singularity. This is a scientific opinion, which I believe, unless and until proven otherwise. It was packed into the singularity, and then, bang, it all exploded and became our still-expanding universe. Now, if anyone could tell me that that is incompatible with the story of creation and the concept of God, I defy them to tell me that that could have happened absent a power that could have created that universe. What happened before? Tantalizing, perplexing, unanswerable. But how did everything fit into that singularity to explode and create the echo that was heard on May 20th, 1964? And so I believe in science, and I believe in God.
Let me, this is Paul. We're going to go a little bit longer than normal. I have to tell you my theology of the Big Bang. And it's my theology of the Big Bang. It's not the science of the Big Bang, because I, too, believe in the Big Bang. Now, without getting into deep Trinitarian thoughts, because it's very Trinitarian, and those are from St. Bonaventure of the 13th century, is where I got my Trinitarian thoughts. But picture this. In the beginning, God existed is infinite. So God existed infinitely. And so you can debate that scientifically all you want, but this is a theology. This is not a science. The very first thing that God created was time and space, because God needs a womb for creation. That everything that is created today, there's a womb. There is a womb in which creation occurs, and this is the womb. And God entered out of infinity, entered into the finiteness of the womb. And through the love of the Trinity, and this could be, this is going to, I'm sure I'll offend people, but this is the sexuality of God, that things, human life is created through a sexual encounter. There was some sort of divine encounter, and that the Big Bang, for me, is an explosion of God into the universe. It is semen exploding into the womb. And everything that grows out of that is God-ordained, has the seal of God, and has the image of God in it. That's what makes me so in love with the Big Bang, is that it fits with my theology of God.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I had never heard that before.
Well, of course not. I made it up.
It's a fascinating idea. But I'll tell you that on page 20 of No Regrets Living is a section of the Believe chapter that is titled God as Scientist. And I look up into that 70 billion trillion star universe, only a tiny fraction of which I can see on a clear night. I look up there and I wonder if God, in fact, is still acting as scientist, and if every one of those stars is a test tube of sorts for what is the best formula, what is the most successful process for creating a divinely inspired world. And the flaw with that theory, of course, is that God should know. And I can live with that contradiction. I can live with the contradiction that God hears our prayers and answers our prayers, but already knew what was going to happen. I can live with the contradiction, self-determination and fate. And how can I live with that? Because I believe. Because there is a gap that belief allows us to fill in. And contradictions for me are not a problem.
No, there's...
I think about them, but they're not a problem.
Yeah, theology is a mystery, and it's a mystery of paradox. It's a mystery of almost antipodal paradox, and that two truths can coexist. And we find that in science, do we not? I mean, do we not?
Absolutely.
You know, what about light? Is it particle or wave? And the answer is yes.
That's exactly right.
You know, it's living in
example.
It's existing in paradox.
That's exactly right.
Let's move on to another one. You know, I mean, I love discovery, heal, and appreciation, but I think with our subject in mind, with regrets, I think there needs to be, we need to talk about acceptance. How can you accept yourself as a flawed, yet deeply loved and deeply appreciated individual by the divine? That we need to accept that part of ourselves. Now, I don't know if you have other ideas of accept, but that's what hits me when I think of accept. And I think it's just critical that we embrace the concept of acceptance.
I agree with you, and that is an important principle of acceptance and of a no regrets living. I think we have to, part of that acceptance is self-forgiveness that we've spoken about before. Part of acceptance is the acceptance of fate, which we've alluded to before, but which has power to be very, very comforting. And if we say that who we are is a matter of fate and not entirely in our control, we have control. We can improve ourselves. We can work toward a better us. We can work toward an ideal. But I think we also have to accept our limitations. We have to accept that which we cannot change. And in doing that, we accept the concept of fate. And we are who we are because that's who we were supposed to be. What happens to us because that's what was supposed to happen. Can we influence what happens to us? Of course. That is a contradiction. I'm comfortable with that contradiction. I'm comfortable that I can influence my fate, but it's still my fate. It still is what's meant to happen, even though I have influenced it. I can accept that contradiction, and I can accept who I am and must accept who I am and recognize that who I am is a result of what I was meant to be.
You know, I so concur. I'm working on a process of working with faith-based executives, and I'm calling it the intersection of knowledge and mystery, and that there is going to be contradiction between knowledge and mystery. We have certain knowledge of scientific knowledge, experiential knowledge, and we have some sort of divine spiritual knowledge from whatever resource we use. But in the midst of that, we cannot disregard, we are talking about God. And if we can define God, this entity no longer is God. There is something unknown, something mysterious, and we have to work with this contradiction, this, again, paradox of having to deal with both mystery and knowledge. Both are true. There is an intersection, but until we sit face-to-face with the divine, we are not going to fully comprehend that intersection.
Let me give you the mathematical equivalent of that, Charlie.
Oh, good.
That's beautifully
good.
Said. There's a mathematical equivalent, and it's on page 42 of the book. And it's something that many people are familiar with, others may not be. It's called the asymptote. And
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. The asymptote is a mathematical concept that there is an arc, and in math, it's an arc. It has a formula, but I use it spiritually to describe what you've just said. There's an upward arc of knowledge, and that upward arc of knowledge approaches a horizontal line, but it never gets there. It gets closer and closer and closer and closer, And there's a, but there is a horizontal line is ultimate knowledge. And the arc is expanding, increasing knowledge. But we never get there. And the gap between that horizontal line and the upward arc that is approaching, 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 but never gets there, that's the mystery.
I love it. What's that called?
It's called an asymptote. A-S-Y-M-T-O-T-E. Asymptote. And it's on page 42. There's a picture. There's a picture of that arc and that horizontal line that do not meet. And the gap between them is what you described. I don't use the word mystery. I love that word. The gap between them is the mystery. And the most important part is we don't know where on that arc we are. We are moving upward on it, but we don't know where. We don't know where on that arc we are. And every time we learn more, we slip back a little bit further because there's more to learn. And we never actually get to total understanding because there's always that mystery in between. And it's that mystery that, for me, is where God exists.
How recent or old is this mathematical equation? Is this new? Has this been around for a long time?
It's been around for a long time. It's sort of part of mathematics, part of physics. And there's actually a formula that people use, a formula that tells you how to describe mathematically that asymptote of an increasing arc that never reaches the horizontal line. And I use that in the book as a concept of the gap between science and total knowledge.
I love it. That is really tremendous. It never reaches, I'm writing this down, that never reaches the horizontal line. Okay, let's move on to our final concept here. This one, one picks what one is interested in, but seeking, as you put, seeking purpose, that fits with a belief in something greater than oneself, an acceptance of fate and of our participation in faith and our sort of a manipulation of faith, but there is a seeking. What's it all about, Alfie? What am I seeking for?
You're dating yourself, Charlie. You're dating yourself.
I know. That's like the 60s, isn't it?
Well, you're absolutely right. And that what's it all about? It's Man's Search for Meaning, the title of psychologist Viktor Frankl's book.
Frankl's book,
the basis, not the book, but the seeking purpose is the basis of that sixth chapter in this book. And for me, the idea of seeking purpose is to become greater than the hummingbird that I talked about. To become greater than the bat that I talked about. When I was writing this chapter on seeking purpose, I was sitting on the back porch and there were starlings, little birds that were flying around. And I thought how simple their existence is. Their purpose is instinctual. The purpose of all animals, maybe not the higher animals, there may be greater purpose for some of the higher species, mm-hmm. but certainly the purpose for the starlings that were flying around. They didn't have to seek purpose. They knew their purpose. It was instinctual. It was feeding their young. It was teaching their young to fly. And then they died. And there probably is a more sophisticated explanation for the purpose of starlings, but starlings don't have to look for it. Starlings have it instinctually. And my goal of seeking purpose in No Regrets Living is to rise above the instinctual. Is to rise above that which comes naturally and seek a greater, you used the word before and I like it, a greater calling. And that distinguishes us from starlings and bats and hummingbirds. We have the privilege of asking what our purpose is, of what is the meaning of life. None of those other species that I mentioned have that responsibility or that ability to seek purpose. They know what their purpose is. Their purpose is instinctual. And I want our purpose to be greater than instinct.
And it harkens back to the belief, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, they're so interconnected. another part. I have, I don't know if it's controversial, but it's not the traditional way all the time. You know, the Westminster Catechism, the chief end of man, and they speak, you know, they speak in gendered terms because this is 100 years
right,
old.
Right.
The chief purpose of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Now that's a nice concept, that, you know, it's worked. It's beautiful. But as I have been studying and praying and reading, I've sort of changed it, and that it has occurred to me in my reading of the scripture, which I'm reading intently, and my reading of the mystics, is that it's rather Epicurean, is that the chief end of man is pleasure. It is to please God. It is to be pleasing to God and enjoy God forever. It is to be pleasing in line with the harmony of the goodness of God. That includes our service, our actions, our praise, our admiration, and then our enjoying that God is, that life is not a drudgery, but it is an enjoying of the intimacy with the divine. So that's sort of my purpose in life now. It's to please God and enjoy God forever.
And by finding that purpose, you have accomplished that. That's a great nexus. When we find our purpose, that has to be pleasing to a creator who has given us that skill,
precisely,
has given us that ability to find our purpose.
Precisely. I so agree. Well, we have reached our time. Dr. Harley Rothberg, you know, this is Paul. I mean, I say this a lot. This is one of my favorite podcasts. We think so much in harmony, and you enlighten me with your thoughts so much. I appreciate you, and I'm sure our listeners do. Thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you, Charlie. It was a pleasure, and it's back at you. You have inspired me, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful for our conversation.
Thank you so much. Let me just thank our listeners. We're so happy that you tuned into the next chapter with Charlie, and please be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.